and welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression. And today you get to have me as your host. I'm Lindsay, and I've been on a few podcasts before here. But we have a really special treat, and that's not me. It's the guests that we have today from Feminist Mormon Housewives, the prolific blog on the internet that is the best blog in the whole world. And I blog there, but I'm not the star of the show tonight. Tonight, I'm going to introduce our panel. We have Lisa. Lisa, do you want to say hi?
Hi.
Lisa is a celebrated and eminent founder of FeministMormonHousewives.org. She's kind of our mother goddess who lives in Idaho. And she's written or been interviewed by the New York Times and Ms. Magazine, CNN, The Tribune. I don't know, a bunch of other ones. She's pretty darn famous. Yeah. And then we have Teresa. Teresa, do you want to say hi?
Hello.
Teresa, you might have seen her work in UK's Guardian. She is our sharp and savvy journalist on our blog. And
that's hilarious.
She writes as Reese Dixon, and she has her own lifestyle blog, reesedixon.com, but she writes for the UK's Guardian, and she's contributed to other articles like patheos.com and Better Homes and Gardens. And I should say that she is a mother of adorable little boy, and Lisa is a mother of three adorable children. And then our last panelist is Sarah. Sarah, can you say hello?
Hello.
Sarah comes to us from 1870s England. No, we've made her say she can't use an English accent tonight. She's our saucy resident atheist and Mormon through my own unofficial law of adoption. Sarah's never been Mormon. She's never been baptized. But she's the director of religious education for the Unitarian Universalist Church of Cheyenne and the mother of two boys.
Three.
So, did I get that right?
She's golden. We're planning on baptizing her here in the next year or so.
We've got her on a track plan.
I'm not getting near a body of water with you people. I have three boys.
Three boys. Sorry. Yeah, that's right. Sorry.
I want full credit for all of them.
You know, if you were a Mormon, you would be behind. I'm just saying. So
I know. I only have three.
Okay, so we're going to get started tonight. We're going to talk about something that will probably shock you. We're going to talk about Mormon feminism. And the reason why we decided to talk about this is I think that there's still a lot of common misconceptions about feminism in general, and especially Mormon feminism. So we're going to kind of talk about, give you a basic Mormon feminism 101 course, and hopefully we can help you understand what we do on our blog, but more specifically, the issues that women are facing in the church and in society. So let's just start with a basic definition of feminism. A lot of people have a lot of crazy ideas of what they think a feminist is. So do you guys want to start us off on what is a feminist? What is feminism in general?
Well, I think you need to be dedicated to the hatred of men.
You have to be a lesbian.
Which is ironic because you also have to want to be a man.
I know. It's internalized self-loathing. I think that's the short definition for feminism.
That's why we burn our bras, right? Because we hate our bodies.
And also, we have to be lesbians.
Yes, which is the fun part.
That's it doesn't hurt.
No, so feminism, I mean, everyone thinks it's the hateful lesbian who doesn't wear makeup and hates, you know, men and society. What is feminism?
I'd say the proper way to begin this discussion of feminism would be to emphasize that there's really no such thing as one feminism. There are a multiplicity of feminisms, depending on your priorities and belief in certain aspects of you know, social justice and all kinds of these issues. But on the whole, the broad definition is just anybody who thinks that men and women should have their contributions and opportunities equally valued.
So wait, does that mean that you want men and women to like look the same and dress the same? Like, you want women to stop wearing dresses and start wearing pants to church, right?
You will get me out of my heels only after you have amputated my feet.
Ooh.
No, I love my heels and my dresses. There are some feminists who feel that makeup and heels is playing into this false beauty paradigm. That tends to be a little bit more of a dated approach to feminism. But it's all about having the choice to freely choose and not have any conscriptions placed on you, and then to have that choice respected.
Yeah, can I bust in there, though, and say that I would really distinguish between informed choice and uninformed choice. Like Tria is saying, you know, yeah, I love my heels, I love my makeup, and I'm making an informed feminist choice to wear them. I don't think that's the same thing as someone who has grown up inside the patriarchy, has only had media that's dominated, you know, by the patriarchy, and is making that choice for very different reasons. I'm not saying, like, burn the witch or she's out of the feminist club, but those aren't the same.
No, I'd definitely agree with that. And for example, women who feel ashamed of their face and will not leave the house without makeup, that would be a problem. That would be an internalized patriarchy. Me, when I wear makeup, it's to enhance features that I like. It's to present myself to the world in a certain way. It is a medium through which I can express myself. And there are plenty of times I leave the house without makeup. And so if it's a choice that I'm doing as an independent agent, something that I am choosing because of what it brings to me instead of something that is imposed upon me, then that would be the feminist distinction.
Well, speaking of leaving the home, Teresa, that just reminded me of another misconception people have. I often hear that feminism is trying to destroy the home and the family, and not just in the religious context. It's the idea of feminism and feminists hate or disagree with women who choose to be mothers or choose to stay home and cook and live in those more traditional roles. What would you say about that?
Well, I'm sure that you are directing this question specifically to me because I am Rhys Dixon of the lifestyle blog, rhysdixon.com, where I write every week about cooking and parenting and crafts you can make to enhance your home. So obviously, I am not out to destroy the home. Again, it's all about informed choice. So if I am making crafts because that is the, like my, you know, like our grandmothers, if I'm quilting because that is the only means of expression that is acceptable for me, that's a problem. If I'm quilting today because I find value in honoring that tradition, in creating a symbol of my art that is also then providing nurturing in the warmth, that tangible artifact that then becomes used, you know, all of that is something that I dedicate my life to and get great value from. But if I'm doing it out of limited options, then that's a problem again. But since I'm doing it because it's where I find joy, where I find a calling, where I find power in creation, then those are all great things to be celebrated.
But, I mean, you talk about options, but like we're in America, right? So women they can do whatever they want, right? Any woman can be a stay-at-home mom if she chooses, and it's her choice.
No? I'd like to sort of speak to that a little bit because I don't, as a stay-at-home mother now of, you know, 12 years, I guess, I don't feel as empowered about it as Teresa does, I guess. I don't feel like it was really a choice that I made as an empowered choice or an informed choice. I felt like it was something I felt sort of trapped into, I guess, a little bit. I felt like I'd been told my whole life that this is what you're supposed to choose. And so therefore, you know, I followed the mommy track and, you know, did all the, and I feel like for the most part that that is the experience of most women. And it isn't that I was actually trapped. I could have made other choices, but because my entire life sort of set me up to make these choices, I, being a good Mormon girl, made the choices I was supposed to make. And then after I'd made them, I realized that perhaps I wasn't as happy as everybody told me I would be.
So when we're talking about like informed decisions, that's what we mean, that mm-hmm. people might have the options or resources available, but they might not just even be aware of that. I mean,
well, and I think I was aware, but I just wouldn't choose that because that's what bad girls do, you know? And obviously I have a different view of that now, and I could still make a different choice. You know, like it's not like after you have children, obviously it's a lot harder to take a different path, and I have not taken that hard road yet, but I hope to someday do so. But I think it's very complicated. It's a very, very complicated, it's a very complicated issue because, certainly there are women who absolutely choose this from a completely empowered mm-hmm. point. And I am all for that happening. But there are also a lot of women, and there are a lot of women who are very happy in that place, in the place of motherhood. And I think that there are some men who are happy in that, you know, stay-at-home father position.
Well, I think that's the idea of, like, people think that feminists want to strip those choices away from women, that they want to take that away, when in reality it's the opposite. We're not trying to take anything away from a person.
I think that is just, yes. I think the vast majority of feminists would absolutely say, I want you to really have a choice one way or the other, both men and women. Like if there are men who want to be stay-at-home fathers, I think that there are plenty of feminists who would absolutely applaud that choice. Now, in actual reality, I think it's a little more complicated because I think that there is sort of an overarching I think in theory, all feminists would say, I want women to be able to choose what they want to do. But I think in practice, there can be, in reality, there are feminists who really don't think, I mean, I've read them, who really don't think that women should be choosing to stay home because, you know, they feel like women are throwing away their potential when they do that. And personally, that has been my experience, but I think that there are women who experience that very differently. So I mean, you can't say that absolutely does not exist. There are feminists who think that way, but I would say that they're a minority, and if pressed, they probably, in theory, would still want women to have the choice, but they just would disagree with the choice, I guess.
I'd say, just to put that in a little more context, the feminists who say that, you know, women are wasting their lives, you know, those are the most extreme just a handful of people who, you know, are selling books and that kind of thing. So while that argument does absolutely exist and would be disingenuous to pretend otherwise, it is not, I would say it's not at all the mainstream feminist view.
I would agree. It's not the mainstream.
And I don't want to... I feel like sometimes, you know, we push back so hard against second wave feminism, you know, that was much more strident and that was much more linear about, like, women just need to get out of the home. And let's be clear, we're talking about white women, since women of color had been out of the home. But I can't believe I'm blanking on her name. Who, I'm trying to think of the CEO. Oh, Therese will know, or who gave that speech where she just said, like, women just need to lean into it a little bit more, like, push.
What's that?
To be, to, you know, expand, you know, to
wasn't
ask
she a Google CEO?
I was just going to say Google. Yeah, I think that's right.
She did a TED Talk.
Right. And I think there's something to saying that, like, okay, you know, staying at home is valuable. Being in the workforce is valuable. But we have to be a little bit more critical, like you both were saying, about how those choices come about, you know, and be willing to be a little bit critical of them, to not just say, like, oh, they're both equal choices, whatever anybody chooses, it's okay. To say, right. Well, you know.
Well, and that's where I want to talk about. I mean, you brought up the issue of privilege, and that privilege can be its own podcast. I mean, it's such a vast topic, but we can talk about that a little bit. I feel like privilege is a word that's often missing from this debate when we talk about what women should be doing and what women shouldn't be doing. First of all, we need to remember that, at least in my case, like, I'm a white American woman. So right away, that gives me privilege over the choices of a lot of women in the world. Mm-hmm. So when I try to make a decision or a choice and say that everybody should be doing it, I need to give some thought to this life situations and the struggles and the limitations that other people have.
Right. I think I was just, I can't remember now where I was reading it, but I was just reading somebody saying that they went on a date and it was a disastrous date. And the date said that women have stayed at home for centuries. And so why should we change it? And that is a perfect example of privilege, because as Sarah mentioned, women of color have not stayed at home. Well, first of all, no women have stayed at home, you know, right. Prior to last century. But women of color have never stayed at home. Poor women have never stayed at home. This is such, it's hard to extrapolate this, especially since we are such a worldwide church. I just think all the time, like when we have lesson after lesson or talk after talk, talking about how important it is for women to stay home and, you know, have clean children and all this, how does this apply at all to women who live below poverty, to women who live in third world countries, to women who live in developed nations where it's just not done that women stay at home? You know, it's just really not a message that is applicable to the majority of people.
Well, and that's, I think that's a good segue to start talking about Mormon feminism in general. Why we're Mormon feminists, and you know, I consider myself a feminist and a Mormon feminist, if we're going to apply all those labels to it. But, you know, my faithful friends in the church see feminism, we kind of call it the F word. They think that, you know, Mormonism and feminism are at odds with each other. And likewise, my ex-Mormon friends actually agree with their faithful counterparts on this. And I've heard them say, you know, there's no such thing as Mormon feminist. You can't be Mormon and be a feminist because the beliefs are so at odds with each other. So let's just talk about, what is Mormon feminism?
Do we want to talk about it from like a historic perspective or a current perspective, or do a little bit of both?
Let's do a little bit of both. We can talk about, you know, early women in the church a little bit and how it's kind of developed. I think that there's a whole discussion to be had about the history of Mormon feminism, but maybe we can focus mostly on what it is today and the issues that we see today in the church.
Right. Just as a broad overview, I mean, just the, you know, the Mormon women of the early church were radical ladies. I mean, they were not quiet Victorian women sitting home and being quiet. I mean, it wasn't at all what their experience was. And so, you know, this idea that, you know, Mormon women have always been these quiet, nurturing souls who, you know, attended to, you know, their homes and their hearths and never did anything beyond that is completely false. Mormon women from the beginning were organizing. And, you know, even the organization of the Relief Society was kind of a radical act. Women's societies really were not that common at that time. They were kind of a new thing, and they were a very radical thing. And so that the church went along with that sort of radical end of what was happening within society, I think, is significant. And then, you know, as we go into Utah and the Mormon polygamists, these were women who were very much leaders in their culture, leaders in their society. They were starting, you know, local relief societies. They started the primary. They started the young women's programs. And they did so very independently. And not only that, but they were incredibly strong advocates for women's right to vote. So they were suffragists, and they associated with the most radical wing of the suffrage movement. because only the most radical wing of the suffrage movement would have anything to do with polygamous women. And so they were sending women out east to become educated, to come back and be doctors. And Brigham Young was actually advocating women to be involved in anything that was useful.
Nothing if not pragmatic. Do you want me to read that? He says, this is from Brigham Young. He said, "I've often told my sisters in the female relief societies, we have sisters here who, if they had the privilege of studying, would make just as good mathematicians or accountants as any man. And we think they ought to have the privilege to study branches of knowledge that they may develop the powers with which they are endowed. We believe that women are useful not only to sweep houses, wash dishes, make beds, and raise babies, but that they should stand behind the counter, study law or physic, medicine, or become good bookkeepers and be able to do the business in any counting house, and this to enlarge their sphere of usefulness for the benefit of society at large." That was right. Brigham Young.
Yeah, and I don't think Brigham Young said those things because he was a radical feminist. He said those things because he was a very practical man, and he saw the needs of Zion, and he saw that women could fulfill them, and that was the way he approached everything. He was very pragmatic about it. So, well, not everything, but a lot of things. So, and it really wasn't until sort of Mormons, went through the whole trying to normalize and become the best kind of Americans and went through the 50s, and the current generation of leaders were being raised in these sort of stereotypical nuclear family homes and had sort of forgotten a little bit about their grandparents' polygamous past and their grandmother's radical feminist histories, that we sort of got this narrative of the, angel in the house or the guardian of the hearth. And that is when, Mormon womanhood sort of took on that narrative. It wasn't the first 100 years of Mormonism by any means. So really, the roots of Mormon feminism, we absolutely have, some history that we can call on to say this is a part of our heritage, and our ancestresses would be proud of us for what we are choosing to do. And I personally, of course, ascribe to that theory. Obviously, there are differences between their brands of feminism and ours. They would never, their brand of feminism was very much hierarchical and never questioned, their subordinates to the patriarchy or questioned any of that sort of thing that we do actually, tend to question.
But I feel like they were more free to explore things. Like they explored the idea of Heavenly Mother a lot more than we do, and the divine feminine a lot more than we do. And women, you touched on this a little bit, we're giving blessings to each other and healing. And so they did some things that we would think are pretty crazy now.
Right,
absolutely. If a woman got up and put her hands on my head and blessed me in front of, the Relief Society, they would probably send us to church discipline, mm-hmm. But that was very common in early church.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so now what do we want to talk about? I guess where Mormon feminism is today.
Yeah, we can talk about that. Teresa, do you want to talk a little bit about Spencer W. Kimball and kind of the influence, like his influential talks? I'm not trying to place the blame on him, because he actually allowed women to start praying in sacrament meetings. So, I mean, there was some progress made under Spencer W. Kimball, but we do have some famous, really great talks from him that Teresa can talk about.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this can still be found in Miracle of Forgiveness, too, where he talks about, he likes to frame it similar to Julie Beck frames it, in this power that women have, this nurturing power to change the world through raising children. And he really strongly encouraged women to fight the evils of the world through creating a home like the temple. And in fact, there's this one part in his book where he talks about how women can heal the world through meeting their children at the end of a school day with bread mm-hmm. and fresh jam. And so he was very much a proponent of women staying at home. And then, of course, his work was then quoted in Benson's talk to the mothers in Zion, where he infamously called for women to come home from the factories and come home from the laundries and quit their jobs and just be stay-at-home moms, which many, many women did and made huge sacrifices to do so.
But why is that bad? I mean, why would we be critical of that? What is wrong with asking women to come home and take care of their kids and bake bread and jam for their children? Why would we have a gripe with that?
Well, anybody else, jump right in. But my problem with that is the limited expression of a woman's talents. Where, I mean, obviously, I love to cook. I love to nurture. I am all about the home. But even I would say that I enjoy having other avenues to use my skills. And there are plenty of women who do not enjoy the home and the homemaking arts the way that I
do. Right here, baby. Right here.
And feel crammed into this box to the detriment of the talents, the God-given talents they actually do have. I mean, you know, I have friends who are brilliant engineers and lawyers and teachers, even and nurses, you know, even fields that aren't so stereotypically male dominated, but just have incredible gifts to contribute to the world in different avenues. And so while it's wonderful to elevate the work of the home, and that's something that I am obviously very committed to doing, it's not the exclusive realm where a woman has something to contribute.
Well, maybe this Go ahead.
I just want to clarify, you know, as a stay-at-home mom who's been doing this for 12 years, it isn't that I hate it. I mean, I do hate it sometimes because I love crafting. I love sewing. I love creating things. Just like Teresa, I don't have a fabulous blog, but I do enjoy those things. And now that my children are not babies anymore, I very much enjoy spending my time with them. I did not enjoy the baby stage. I didn't like anything about that, but that's just because I'm a terrible, terrible person.
Nope, I'm the same way. I'm the same way. They just lay there and look at you. What else are you supposed to do?
Yeah. You know, and there are many aspects to the nurturing realms that I deeply enjoy. I like cooking, actually. I don't like cleaning up afterwards, but I enjoy it very much. I don't want to have to do it every single night, but, you know, there are a lot of things about that mothering and nurturing and I love hanging out with my kids. I love reading books to them. I love, you know, so, but I do feel like telling me that these are my only options makes me, and has in my past made me feel really helpless and tortured and, trapped and unhappy. I tried so hard to be happy in that role, and I expected to be happy in that role, and I was so shocked when I wasn't. Mm-hmm.
I think that
so that's why.
Well, and that whole statement that like it would fix the ills of the world, that is a loaded gun. I mean, it isn't just a positive statement saying, oh, you know what, it'd be really nice to greet your kids with, you know, some bread and some jam. It's a much larger statement about if the world is in shambles, ladies, look to yourselves. You know, right. if you weren't out in the workforce and fulfilling your own selfish desires, maybe the world wouldn't be in the mess that it's in.
You know, like, I think that this also ignores the fact that there are many different ways to nurture. For example, while Lisa might not have enjoyed the baby years, she is incredibly gifted at nurturing this community that she has created at Feminist Mormon Housewives and all
like
of the women.
I think that she breastfeeds us all. That's how I like to think of it.
We don't nurturing once we hit 18, and I think Lisa's a prime example of how gifted she is in nurturing different aspects of the journey.
Can we also address though that men are not exempt from nurturing? I mean, I right. grew up with that idea in the church that men are nurtured, or women are nurturers, and men are, you know, the breadwinners. Mm-hmm. And that's been one of the greatest things feminism has given me, is to see that some men are a lot better nurturers than I am. And it's and mm-hmm. it's more innate, you know, like nurturing is something I've had to work for.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, men or women, come by it naturally.
I think yes, that's absolutely true.
Can we just pause for a moment to talk about the conversation I just had in the car with all of my children, in which they told me that my husband is a much better mother than I am?
Oh, knife in the heart.
I'm telling Spencer W. Kimball that they said that. And I'm sure your bishop will be calling you soon.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Let's talk about, I mean, I often hear, I was just talking to a friend on the way here, and who, you know, doesn't really get Mormon feminism. And he was saying, I just don't understand, like, you know, men have the priesthood, they have their responsibilities. It's not like it's that big of a deal. And women have their thing. They have relief society. I just don't see, like, why you guys think the church is sexist. I just don't see it. And, you know, I was kind of the same way growing up. I was really happy in the system. I thought women were valued. I mean, we hear about how great women are all the time. So maybe...
My understanding is that BYU in the 70s was a haven of feminism. But I've just been reading Naismith a lot, so I could have it wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, right? We know how to empower women. Well, but we do. I mean, we have these conferences to empower women. We have all, you know, at BYU, right? Isn't that where they have the women's conference every year, and women come back feeling really inspired and empowered, which I also think means they come back feeling really guilty on things that they should be doing or yeah. things that they shouldn't be doing. But let's talk about, it was a big eye opener for me when I was first getting into these issues. I got on LDS Wave site that Teresa has helped found. And they kind of listed some of the issues, just like a list of where women are not equal to men. Can we just talk about, maybe just list some of those issues? Teresa,
well, I wish we had the infographic. Cynthia L. from BCC's ward breakdown. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Mm-mm.
Oh, that was amazing.
Yeah. Tree, explain it, because I don't know all of the... titles.
Well, the church, let me see if I can pull it up really quickly. The newsroom has been releasing all these infographics for the press to understand how Mormonism works. And they had one, and I didn't see the original one, but it talked about church leadership, you know, just prior to conference, like how this all works. And they had, you know, pink for women and blue for men, and they kind of showed how this all broke down. And, you know, Cynthia at BCC felt like it was not quite a genuine representation. And so she redid it. And it's really stark to see it right there in blue and pink, how the leadership roles break down and how, you know, when conferences are given, there are just these rows of blue men representing the speakers. And then there's two pink women just floating out there in that sea, and that effect goes all the way down the line. And where it really starts to get just shocking is when you see the ward level and you recognize that being a deacon is a priesthood office, and they have responsibilities that women don't. I mean, you know, we often say in Mormon feminist circles that if not a single woman was there, you could hold all the church meetings you wanted to. But without a man, we cannot, well, in most places, you cannot even get into the building without a man, a priesthood, somebody there to supervise or chaperone or who knows what. But you can't conduct a meeting. You can't perform an ordinance. You can't do anything without a man there. And even positions like primary president, which theoretically can have a male teacher that she is responsible for, she still reports to a bishop. And so, and that is like the only example that I could think of where, I mean, maybe if you had a man on like the, well, they don't even have an activities committee anymore. So there really is maybe just that one opportunity for a man to serve with a woman leader, whereas a male leader will always, always be over a woman in every single circumstance.
One of the most powerful things for me, you guys can remind me who wrote this. I saw the post where they regendered the sacrament meeting. Do you remember that post? Someone.
Oh, yeah. The pink. What was it?
It was like a walk in pink moccasins by Carolyn Pearson.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And they talk about, I mean, if you are skeptical that there's any sexism in the church, go sit in a sacrament meeting at your local ward. And in your mind, switch out where there's a male, switch it out for a female. So pretend that the bishop is a female and pretend that his counselors are female. And then pretend that the people passing sacrament are female. And then pretend in your own pew, in your own row, switch out the male and female and see if you can kind of see that there's this imbalance there. I mean, we're so used to seeing the boys pass the sacrament and the bishop presiding. It just seems natural to us. But if we were to switch it and put women in those positions, how comfortable would many of us be with women presiding and doing all the ordinances and telling us and instructing us on how to do these things?
And I would be very comfortable.
even as a woman who has been involved in Mormon feminism for, I guess, a long time now, I guess I'm getting old. But my education, my feminist education has been very much been, you know, like being self-educated through blogging. I've never like been formally educated on what it means to be a feminist. And I've never been educated. I don't feel particularly knowledgeable about doctrine or policy or the church or everything I know about Mormon feminism. I've learned through the people that I've interacted with online and, you know, through books that I've read and things. But as I still to this day, even after 8 years of blogging about Mormon feminism, I still don't always hear the sexism in the way that our leaders speak to us. And I'm often shocked when I step back and do role reversal in talks and at how sexist it is if you change it from a man speaking to women and change it as if it were a woman speaking to a man. I mean, just as a prime example, when I went to go write the April Fool's Day post that I did this year about how we were going to start a male auxiliary, I went and I actually picked some pretty standard talks to do a role reversal with. And I had listened to those talks and had thought, you know, after 8 years, I felt it. But then when I actually sat down and wrote out the role reversal, like I would hesitate and say to myself, oh, I can't really write that. That sounds too awful. And then I would go back and read what he had written and I actually wrote exactly what he wrote. I had just switched it. But when I switched it, when I heard it the first time, I had a minor twinge. When I switched it, it made me kind of want to vomit. And I almost couldn't print it because I felt like it went too far.
Well,
but
some of it was like,
because,
you know, we talk about women being praised, right? Like women are so great and so powerful and strong. And that's kind of what you did on your post. You took some of those quotes where women were being praised, right?
Right.
And picture a man being talked to that way in the church. I think that would make a lot of men feel uncomfortable. I remember the language.
One of the quotes that just made me want to, you know, vomit was when I said, men, you have a purpose, you know, like, okay. I've never, ever heard a woman tell men that. Why would she? Men, you have a purpose. Like,
where's
can
that?
You imagine?
I'm going to look up that incredible women, LDS women are incredible talk. That's a great one to go look and regender. That was in conference like 2 years ago, was it? But, I think that here's the problem that I see. A lot of Mormons say, well, okay, yeah, men are in leadership. That's fine. But women have their jobs to do and their roles to do, too. First of all, women get to be mothers. They get to be mothers. you know, so why aren't we content with that? Because, you know, men, they're not as inherently spiritual as women are, and they need the priesthood to kind of keep them righteous. How would you guys, let's talk about how we respond to that argument.
I would really love to address that. Speaking, one, as a mother of a boy who takes great offense at anyone telling me that he is less spiritual or less anything than anybody else, but also
the damage we do to our young men when we tell them that over and over again. It really makes me angry.
Yeah. And also, as a woman who has gone through 8 years, well, actually 12 years now that I'm going through secondary infertility, it's just so blatant that not all women are mothers. And despite the well-meaning efforts of Sherry Dew, we are not all mothers. There is great contributions I felt like I could make before I had children, but it was absolutely, fundamentally not the same thing. The level of intimacy, the level of sacrifice, the level of connection, the depth of the relationship, like none of those things are the same thing. And of course, then there's also the fact that women get to be mothers and men get to be fathers. The corollary is not motherhood, priesthood. The corollary is motherhood, fatherhood, priesthood, and then a big fat open space that has yet to be filled in.
Yeah. Can I just add though that like Teresa is not saying like you don't understand intimacy or love or sacrifice until you're a mother.
Yes. Thank you for making that plain. Yeah. Believe me, I have the infertility cred. That is not where I'm going with that. All of those things are achievable, but not within that same framework. Like I cannot, as a young woman's leader, have the same relationship with one of my young women that her mother does. That is not the same. I can have intimacy and sacrifice and love and all of those things in different formats, in different ways. And I can contribute and I definitely had things to contribute and had worthwhile relationships and learned great lessons during those years of infertility. But it is just not the same thing.
Well, how would you address criticism that, you know, women like us just want power, we're power hungry, that we just, you know, want to lead and want to be in charge?
Lean into it. Be a little less embarrassed about it.
Yeah, I think we're conditioned exactly to be embarrassed about it. I mean, we have the pride cycles in the Book of Mormon, and of course that can be applied to men and women, but women are not supposed to want power. We're supposed to be humble. I guess men aren't supposed to want power either, but men get the power naturally.
Well, and I think that every ward has that guy who openly aspires to callings, right? That guy who like struts around and makes sure that everybody knows he's available and can carry a mantle of authority and is just waiting for the day.
The most perverse is the one who's the most obviously humble, who's like going out of his way to be ostentatiously humble.
I mean, those guys exist, but they are admired by a certain population and they are tolerated by the rest. Whereas a woman who tried to strut around and say, I'm ready to take on a mantle of authority. You can put me wherever you need me. I'm ready. Like, are you kidding me? That would be a witch who would be shown the door.
Yeah. Anytime a woman in the church, I feel like is, you know, more assertive or aggressive in getting something, like, you know, we've all heard stories of the mean Relief Society president or Young Women's president that going on a rampage for a bigger budget or something like that, she is automatically labeled as
difficult.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, in conference, we have these women modeled for us. They're sweet and polite and kind and smiling. And, that's the kind of women that are modeled for us.
This happened to me when I was Young Women's president. I was newly called, and the outgoing Young Women's president had made this arrangement with the young men's president, and it was an arrangement that I did not agree with. I did not feel like it was a good use of resources. So I went to him just to have a very straightforward discussion, and he told me, he literally said, well, the ship has sailed, and he refused to budge. And so I was ready to then, you know, well, let's go have a meeting with the bishop and, you know, do the next thing that you would normally do. But I had one of the outgoing counselors pull me aside and say, this is not going to work. Just let him fail. Just smile and nod. And, you know, you don't want to get a reputation. So just, you know, let this proceed for a little while and it won't work out anyway. And so the choice was speak up, save money, save time, create a more positive experience for the youth and be labeled difficult, or waste time, you know, hurt feelings, waste money, allow some of the young people to have a negative experience and not be difficult. Like, either I had to take the bullet or the young people had to take a bullet, you know, because they, heaven forbid, we just address this like I would in the business world and, you know, sort it out amongst ourselves.
Yeah, and I think that this isn't just exclusive to Mormonism, but in society in general. I mean, we have tropes of what women are, and a trope is just kind of almost like a stereotype that we hear played over and over. And you see this in politicians all the time. I like to use Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton, because you have Sarah Palin, who was, you know, sweet and feminine, and she got criticized for being stupid.
And hot,
yeah. And her identity got reduced to being like the hot MILF. I heard her being called the MILF all the time. But it worked for her in a certain way. There was a certain group of people that really attached to that idea of she's a sweet, kind, submissive, pretty woman. Whereas you have Hillary Clinton, who she's less feminine and more assertive, and she gets labeled...
Whoa, I don't know about that. Less feminine.
Oh, less feminine in her dress. Like, she, you don't see her wearing short shorts on the cover of a magazine, right? You see her wearing her pantsuits. And right. So,
does that mean feminine?
I think in society, yes. Maybe
traditionally, yeah. Presents traditionally in that gender. Yeah. I'd support you, Lindsay.
Yeah. Well, I feel like Hillary Clinton gets. I hate to say this word, but she's the bitch, right. You know, and you have Sarah Palin is the slut. So women can't win. But in the church, you can't really be the bitch, but you can be the sweet, submissive woman. And that gives you power to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the only way for me to have gotten things done was to kind of keep the front of the sweet Mormon woman.
Mm-hmm.
Be assertive, but under the front of the sweet Mormon woman.
Right.
Well, and Lindsay, you've talked before about how that dynamic set up other women as your competition.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me to do that, for me to be the good mom and the good wife and the good Mormon woman, that meant I had to set myself apart from other Mormon women. So if I were a better cook than someone, that gave me power. Which, that sounds silly, but I mean, in the church, if your power is attached to, if your role, your divine role is attached to motherhood and homemaking, that's what I had to be good at, right? Because that's what I was striving for. That's how I express my divinity. And so my intentions were good. I wanted to be a good homemaker and a good mother. But not only that, I wanted to be a really good one. So if someone had a good recipe, well, I was going to make a better one. I was going to figure out how to do it better. And it worked for me, because then people would say, oh my goodness, Lindsay, that's such a great casserole. Will you come teach it in Relief Society, or, you know, the recipe? And I found power and opportunities through that. And I didn't see that it was on the backs of other people in the ward who had no interest in that, or, you know, didn't have the skills or the resources to do that kind of thing.
You know, Jessica from the LDS Wave Board, she's Jessa Y at Exponent 2. She talks about her feminist awakening coming when she asked her husband what woman was his spiritual idol. What woman did he look up to spiritually? And he could not name one. And I think that one of the reasons for that is because we have come to see these acts of casserole baking and bearing children and handouts on Sunday for our primary class. We have come to see that as an expression of a woman's religiosity. And so if a woman is going to be a spiritual giant, it's most often the woman who, you know, is baking the best casserole. You know, it's like when you think of who's the spiritual giant in your ward, she's either the wife of a prominent leader or somebody who fulfills that gender role to a T, instead of somebody who can preach, who can testify, who has great gospel insight, who, you know, practices a very Christ-like life. You know, those aren't our heroes. It's women who have married a leader or somebody who knows how to fulfill this rigid gender role.
Okay, so I want to talk for a second about my mother and my aunt, Mary. They were both, you know, good Mormon women, but neither of them really fit the sweet Mormon woman stereotype. You know, they're both just go-getters. You know, they go and get what they want and they say what they mean and you know, I'm not exactly how they turned out this way within Mormon culture, but I have seen the way that it affects them in that My mom and her sister have both accomplished what I think are amazing things and lived amazing lives. And, you know, like, but neither of them have ever really served in like leadership roles in the church. And if you were to ask them, you know, like who they look up to, it's always these women that are very much not like them. These women that are kind of quiet and submissive and they don't see the value in who they are. Like, even though they fundamentally have always been who they are. And, you know, I could tell you stories about my mother and my Aunt Mary getting in trouble for speaking their minds at church. I have a whole, I have a whole suitcase full of stories of, you know, them getting in trouble for, you know, saying it how it is and yet still living very much within supporting the patriarchy and raising children who support the patriarchy. You know, like you really couldn't find better Mormon women, but they do not admire themselves because they don't fit the stereotype. And I always, it just makes me really sad. There's a woman in my ward who I think of this way too. Like she always has the most beautiful spiritual insights and her lessons when she's allowed to give them are the most beautiful, spiritually enlightening lessons that I've probably just about ever had in church. But she'll always say things like, oh, I promised myself I wouldn't raise my hand today, but I just have to say something. You know, like she has this constant desire to silence herself and to feel like that her voice isn't worthy or I don't know. It's a problem.
Yeah. And I saw that too. I mean, I saw that I was really good at things that, like cooking or crafting, that didn't really matter in the religious context, and that women that had a lot of things to offer in that way often felt really insecure about it or about themselves and their position in the ward. And I think back on that now, how silly and actually sad that is, that these women who have so much to offer feel like they don't belong or that they're doing something wrong or that they're somehow failing in their divine roles. Because they can't manifest it in these outward marks that we give them, like, you know, how white and ironed their kids' shirts are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I think for me that gets back to just how powerful the church is in crafting its narrative. You know, every Mormon woman I know has a pretty similar ideal about that perfect Mormon woman. I mean, we went to our ward here in town, you know, when my son Atticus was 3 years old, one time. And for a year afterwards, he could identify a picture of Mormon Jesus, even if it was like holding a pterodactyl and was like a satire. He knew that was Mormon Jesus, and he knew it was the church that was about Jesus and families. And I think like the narrative about... what a good Mormon woman looks like and how gentle and submissive and, you know, all powerful her muffins are. it's just enormous. And what's weird to me is how homogenized that story is, even among women who have wildly different experiences that obviously directly contradict it. But, like, they don't go with their own experiences. They go with that meme.
So we have that. I mean, we have this constantly given to us in conference and in our women's conferences and in Relief Society manuals. And the idea is to strengthen the home, which I think all of us would agree is a great goal. I don't think anyone has any qualms about strengthening your home and your family and spending time. But the problem is...
Oh, I do. I think we should destroy all children in an orphanage.
That's true, but, you know, you have no soul, so...
No. Yes.
I'm kidding.
I actually think we should just eat our children.
I thought that was Sarah's job. She's the atheist, so she's supposed to think that, right? No, so we have this stereotype that's constantly perpetuated, but it's not just a stereotype. I mean, it's given to us in the Proclamation to the Family. I think, like, that's a big one for a lot of us feminists, but I think that there's some small things, too, that we've missed, like, that a lot of us miss, like, the idea that, you know, we talked about men being more prominent in the church. I actually pulled up Wave's list.
I've got it here in front of me, too.
Oh, do you want to go down it for us? The okay. I Feel Unequal one? It's so great.
Yeah. Okay, so the Wave list, which was written by Chelsea Shields Strayer. It's an amazing thing. But it's quite long, so let me just kind of scan down and see what we haven't touched on yet. One that I think is great is how she emphasizes that men handle 100% of the church finances. Women never handle any of the money. They can request changes in budget, but that's all they get. They don't accept tithing or have anything to do with any of that. Let's see.
But the doctor told me when I had my son that he said, well, because your son has a penis, he is going to be able to handle the finances. I thought that was like a medical condition.
That's where the financial brain is. Let's see. Women and men are often called different titles when doing the same job, such as sister versus president, or are treated as accessories rather than serving equally with their husbands, such as vision president's wives. Women who are auxiliary leaders have to get every decision approved by a man, and they are not invited to attend, and thank goodness this is starting to be a little more flexible, but they are often not invited to attend priesthood executive committee, where a lot of decisions are made that affect women-run organizations. A woman's value is primarily linked to being a wife and mother rather than a child of God independently working out their own salvation. Let's see, women have less prominent or public roles in the church despite their age. Having a new baby, there's no way for a woman to participate in the ritual of the blessing. The husband presides and is supposed to be, you know, the head and have the final say of all decisions. Let's see, the men make all the decisions when it comes to callings. Women can maybe offer some input, but that can always be overridden. Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts usually have a larger budget than young women's, and they are also allowed to do fundraising. Young men and young women's have different manuals, budgets, activities, everything that often create an unequal teaching environment. Fathers and mothers are both given these primary roles to provide and nurture, but men get to explore however they want to provide, whatever career, whatever level, whatever income, and wherever that comes from, that's all up to their discretion, whereas mothers' best way to nurture is to be stay-at-home moms, and that is pretty cut and dried. This I'm going to quote Chelsea directly because I think it's just so brilliant. She says, "I feel unequal when men teach me that being a stay-at-home mother is the most important thing a person could do, and yet most of them do not do it."
Oh, amen.
That is so great.
Amen. And that's the same talk that's crazy-making about Heavenly Mother. Like, who in your actual life that you love and revere, do you never talk about?
Yep. Let's see. Most of the lessons and songs are about men. Even in really in Young Women's, you know, we've got like four lessons a year on the priesthood and the young men and elders quorum and high priest. They never learn about Relief Society. There are specific women's issues that men are not trained for or experienced with, such as sexual abuse, domestic violence, women's health, and yet are given free rein to advise on, including how to wear your garments while you're breastfeeding or having a period, the exact way to repent from a sexual encounter that maybe was coercive at best and rape at worst. Questions of modesty and repentance from sexual sins that do not take into account a woman's experience with those factors, that women have not only their own desires, but their own pressures that are distinct from men and that definitely play a role in temptation and why a woman would choose to sin. And going back to modesty specifically, it's almost always spoken of as a way of controlling and being responsible for the lusts and thoughts of men instead of a means of expression to the world and self-respect and controlling their own experience with the world. Instead, it's always, you know, don't be walking porn. Very few women's voices are included in church manuals. Women do not speak in priesthood meetings. In the priesthood session of conference, you will never see a woman there. Well, you will, as of yet, you won't see a woman there. And yet every Young Women's meeting, every Relief Society meeting, women are always going in on the conference level, you know, the general level, but always also on the ward level. We often have a bishop come in and share a thought with young women, a counselor come in and share a thought with Relief Society, but you never see a woman sharing a thought with a priesthood quorum. Women... men and women can be sealed to different numbers of people, and that also influences temple divorces in this life as well. Women cannot usually have a temple divorce unless they are ready to marry another person in the temple, regardless of what that first marriage was like. And so you can have a woman who cannot get temple divorced from an incredibly abusive man because of these rules, that it's better for a woman to be sealed to anybody, no matter, even if he's abusive, than nobody. Meanwhile, a man can be sealed to multiple partners. And then, of course, we have how we approach Heavenly Mother, that when we do talk about her, it's always in a way that that's a bit taboo, and that we perpetuate this myth that we don't know more about her and we don't speak of her more often because she's too sacred, or you know, this idea, we impose this idea of chivalry onto the heavens, that Heavenly Mother is some fragile flower that has to be protected from our base instincts rather than revere her as a creative goddess who can have tremendous power in our lives.
Yeah, and Tree, can I say something about, like, if the question is, like, what is Mormon feminism for, or, you know, what is its aim? I think just having that conversation and changing that really, like, entrenched, powerful narrative where people say with a straight face, I mean, I feel like saying, oh, we worship, you know, Mother in Heaven, we just don't talk about her, is really not different from saying, freedom is slavery. Black is white. What? Does that sound weird?
Well, and I think, is it Margaret Toscano? And I'm not a cusser, but she said, mothers deal in shit, you know, and puke and diapers and the worst things of human beings. You know, mothers deal with those. That's a big part of motherhood. So to say that our mother is too sacred to talk about when some of the toughest things in life are dealt with by mothers is not only offensive, it's silly. And
well, actually, I think I want to get on that train. I think that I am too sacred to be dealing with this stuff. I am too sacred to change diapers. I am
we'll just
too
disappear.
Sacred to listen to you people whine anymore.
Well, Lisa, I think we should have
tell
our
you to put your socks away.
I think we should have a whole podcast on Heavenly Mother, but. Lisa, when Teresa was going down the list, I was thinking of your healthy chastity post that you wrote. And that was some kind of enlightening for me, too. It never occurred to me how inappropriate it was for a woman to confess her sins to a man with no female representative. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. You know, that was I personally didn't ever question it when I was growing up. I went into the bishop's office and he asked me about my sex life, and I told him about my sex life when I was 14 years old, which consisted of not even knowing what sex was, but that was my sex life. You know, and then that continued right up until I was going to get married, and the bishop asked me about my sex life. And now that I think back on it, that is such an unnatural, and it felt unnatural. It did. At the same time that it was completely expected, it was incredibly uncomfortable. And it never occurred to me to question it either. It never occurred to me to question it. And it wasn't until I was well into blogging about Mormon feminism and heard about some of the things that happen, some of the questions I was never asked incredibly inappropriate questions, but some young women are asked incredibly inappropriate questions, and some young men are asked incredibly inappropriate questions. And it wasn't until I started really thinking about, you know, the wisdom of putting an untrained middle-aged man in a small enclosed space with a vulnerable child who is perhaps, you know, not the most wise steward of their own sexuality, and then just letting that happen all over all the time. That's just creepy. And it's so, as a Mormon, I never questioned it. It never occurred to me that that was wrong. And even while I was experiencing it and it was incredibly uncomfortable, I still never questioned it. Never. Until I started, you know, hearing the experiences of abuse that came out of that situation and realizing what an inappropriate system we have set up. It's not, I can understand the problem that they are dealing with in that, you know, we have these beliefs in chastity and we have these beliefs that, you know, you need to be worthy in order to participate in, you know, certain sacred events. And I don't think that that is something that we should take lightly or that we should do away with. But I do think that we have to reevaluate the means by which we assess that worthiness in our young people, especially. And I guess, you know, I can't think of any perfect solution to it. You know, a part of me thinks that it's really not appropriate to ever question somebody about their sexuality unless they come to you. You know, like if you are a counselor and someone seeks out your wisdom and you have been trained to impart wisdom to somebody in a way that has been, you know, proven to be effective and helpful, why then yes, that's appropriate. But outside of those circumstances, I think that we are going to have to really look at as a culture at the way that we handle this. And I don't have a perfect solution. The one thing that I did come up with that I thought might be useful is that when I was thinking about it, I was thinking about initiatories and how, you know, because, you know, we've talked many times about how, is it possible that women already have the priesthood because they perform sort of these priesthood functions within the temple? And that, you know, that's just a debate that goes on. I don't have a real strong stance on it. I sort of like the idea of that, but obviously, I don't really know. But, you know, if in that circumstance, women are given the keys to perform certain functions that otherwise would be given to a priesthood, I thought, well, then perhaps because we have clearly a system that is so dysfunctional and creepy that perhaps we could extend to young women's leaders or Relief Society presidents, or even, you know, I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if we could have like trained counselors? I don't know if that would be possible, but you know, if the church could spend some of their billions of dollars in training, you know, counselors, actual counselors for the different wards that you know, that hold Mormon values, but who are also, you know, that have the knowledge they need in order to not ask creepy questions or implant harmful ideas of sexuality, or, you know, not notice that a person is telling you that they were date raped and instead asking them to repent for having just been raped. You know, like those things need to be fixed, and they need to be fixed mm-hmm. as soon as possible.
Well, and I think I would recommend every listener to go to feministmormonhousewives.org and look up Lisa's post. It's called 13 Articles of Healthy Chastity. Is that right?
Yeah.
And she kind of lists, like, you know, the problems that she talked about and some solutions. And it's really enlightening. And I think that's an issue that needs to be addressed really fast with our leaders mm-hmm. in the church. And that, you know, we're running out of time. And I thought that would be a good thing to talk about. We've brought up all these problems. And I think some people think, well, okay, so what now? What is it that we want? Are there solutions? Is our solution just to sit here and gripe about it? What is there anything that can be done? Is change possible in the Mormon church?
Well, you know, one of the things I think that Teresa should talk about is, didn't Wave also come up with another list of, or was that Natalie? Who was it that came up with a list of changes that the church could make that would require no change in priesthood ordinances that would create a more equal playing field for women in the church? Go, Chief.
Yeah, Nat Kelly did one at FMH, and then it's something that we talk about a lot at WAVE. This is kind of our mission, is to encourage gender equity within the church. And
Teresa, will you really quick just tell us about WAVE and what it is really fast?
Yeah, WAVE stands for Women Advocating for Voice and Equality. And WAVE stands for Women Advocating for Voice and Equality. And our mission is to advocate for gender equality within the LDS Church. And the way we hope to accomplish this is from both a top-down and a bottom-up method. So we do enter into conversations wherever we can with church leaders on a general level. But we also do a lot to empower local leaders, because a lot of these problems are systemic. They are fundamental, that are not going to be able to be changed except at the general level. Problems with the temple ceremony, a great local leader cannot do anything about. So we engage in those conversations wherever we can. But on the local level, there's so much that can be done to include women's voices. And that is something we've actually got another, we're publishing our second book this year, and it's going to be specifically on how to incorporate women into local practice. And it's everything from addressing these issues that we've talked about with giving male leaders a little bit of understanding about when and when not to talk about women's health, their garments, sexual abuse, you know, rape, all of these issues, from everything from, you know, that extreme to, you know, how to encourage women to speak up in ward council, ideas for incorporating Daughters of My Kingdom to encourage men to learn more about the women's history. The whole book is chock full of addressing these things, but there really is so much that we can do. Rules that already exist, that local leaders just have to be empowered to do it and be a little bit creative. Things as simple as getting, and I bring this up all the time and I am always lambasted for it, but changing tables in men's bathrooms, because they are there in some, but it's because either the building is new or a local leader took initiative. But if just a changing table was in a man's bathroom, how simple and stupid a change is that. But that makes a huge difference to the contributions a woman can make on Sunday, to how fatherhood is reverenced on Sunday. I mean, if women can't even see that basic and simple of a need being met, then it's incredibly disheartening for anything else. And so these simple steps can lead to creating an environment where women feel more included and are more apt to speak up themselves.
That's great. Does anyone else want to offer any, like Lisa, do you want to talk about what we're doing with Feminist War and Housewives, just providing a place of community?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the problems that is difficult as a Mormon woman is that there is, along with the sweetness and light that is expected of Mormon women, there lacks a certain amount of allowance for talking about the difficulties of whatever, whether it's the difficulties of motherhood or the difficulties of marriage or the difficulties of, you know, being a woman in the church. Those are just not conversations that are really popular to bring up in religious society. It makes women very nervous to say, if you say something like, you know, I really feel like the bishop treated me unfairly. Gee, that is just ripe for that's like dropping a lead balloon. And so because there's just really no place to go, you can't go to your girlfriend at church. You can't go to your mom. You can't go to, there's just really no space for women to go to talk about the things that we struggle with in a really honest and open way. And I think that all of the women blogs, provide that. But I think specifically a lot of the blogs that, Exponent and Feminist Woman Housewives and Fluffled Daughters, and I think that they provide an outlet for women to have their voices be heard and to speak their truth and not have somebody tell them, because it is so common in Mormon culture to say, you know, here was my experience, and then to have someone tell you that really didn't happen. And that's a very difficult thing to have happen to you, because you start to question your own sanity. You start to question your experience. You start to question your voice and your perceptions of reality. And if no one ever says, yes, I hear you, that has happened to me, or yes, you know, your experience is real and we hear you, then, you know, you can really live a life of isolation. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, while we do get people who come on to FMH and say, why do you just talk all the time? Why don't you ever do anything? I feel like within Mormon culture, having a place to talk is one of the most important things we can do. And it isn't to say that, you know, we don't want to move into, you know, doing certain things that can be done to make, you know, lives better for women. But the first step just absolutely has to be letting women know that their voices matter and that they have a right to speak. I know that just recently in my own ward, I was talking to my bishop and I asked him if we couldn't have more Sunday school teachers that were women. And he told me that he has tried very hard to find women willing to teach Sunday school. And every woman he asks turns him down because they don't feel like they have anything worth listening to.
It's heartbreaking.
Well, that's what I'd encourage any of the listeners out there who are interested in these issues or want to learn more or feel like they disagree with things that we've said to go out there in what we call the blogger knuckle. There's FeministMormonHousewives.org, there's the Exponent and the Wave and Zelful, I can never say that word. What is it?
The Leverhead Daughters.
Yes. Those are just some of the great feminist Mormon blogs out there. There's Daughters of Mormonism podcast. So there are some really great resources to kind of educate yourself on these issues. And Mormon Expression has been really generous. They're going to help Feminist Mormon Housewives hopefully produce some more podcasts. And we're going to talk about some of these issues in depth a little bit more. So I just wanted to say thank you for all of you guys being on tonight and being willing to talk about this and being patient with me doing this. So thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lindsay. You did great.
Lindsay.
I'm learning. I'll get it someday. And thanks for listeners for being patient. Hopefully we'll get this figured out, and we hope to see you guys around on the internet and in our works. Thanks.